Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means Lehigh Valley Discourse with interesting guests, and I have two of them this evening. My name is John Pierce. I'm your host. Neil Heaver is our engineer this evening. My guests are from Muhlenberg College, Dr. Ben Carter. Do you prefer Ben or Benjamin?
Ben, please.
All right. Benjamin is reserved for your mother when she needed you to clean the room?
I don't know that it's reserved for anybody. it's on everything official. That's
official.
About it.
All right. But you like Ben. And also Sean Kenny, who is a recent graduate. Congratulations, Sean.
Thank you.
Was it a tough grind? Did you spend 4 years at Muhlenberg?
4 years, yeah.
All right. Were they the best years of your life?
Think so.
So far, anyway. Well, yeah, we can't say yet, right?
Yeah.
Ben, I've always been amused as somebody said, to tell a student who's in college, these are the best years of your life, does that mean when you graduate, it's all just downhill from there?
I hope not.
Yeah. Anyway, we say that a lot for college students. So this evening's topic is anthropology or...
So I always say I'm an archaeologist because people know what that is or have an idea of what that is before they know what anthropology is. So that sometimes there's a bit of a disconnect if I say I'm an anthropologist. They're like, not sure what that is.
Yeah.
So, but I would say to my colleagues, I always say I'm an anthropologist first because essentially what that means is that I study people.
Right.
And so, and we study people in a very sort of holistic way. We care about sort of every aspect of what it means to be human, both from a evolutionary perspective, from a modern American society perspective, and from other societies all over the world, including, of course, as an archaeologist, I focus pretty much on societies who are gone.
All right. Is it the case that you cannot describe yourself as either anthropologist or archaeologist, but both of them?
Yes. As a matter of fact,
depending on what you're doing.
If we really go into the details, I always call to my colleagues. I usually say I'm an anthropological archaeologist.
Sean, that sounds highfalutin, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would say that archaeology kind of is a subset of anthropology, so it kind of follows like that.
Right.
I like to tell people like, oh, I'm an anthropologist with an archaeology focus.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Well, let me tell our listeners that Dr. Carter has a Bachelor of Arts degree from Drew University in nearby New Jersey. And by the way, beautiful campus. I love the forest.
Definitely a beautiful campus.
Yes, indeed. And you did your bachelor's degree in anthropology with minors in archaeology and chemistry. Interesting.
Correct.
That you have chemistry in there too.
Well, as with many students going off to college, I didn't really know what archaeology was. I knew I wanted to pick a school that had it because I was sort of interested in exactly what I'm not sure, but I knew I was pretty good at chemistry. So I started off college doing chemistry because I knew what that was, and then once I started taking archaeology and anthropology classes, I knew that that was what
I wanted.
You
were really hooked on those.
Right, and I'm still, I love doing chemistry when I get a chance. You know, you can do sort of all sorts of chemical analyses in archaeology, and I still love doing that.
So. That's a great background for you to have for the archaeology, yeah. How about cooking? Are you one of our finer chefs?
That's a loaded question.
Is your wife listening?
Hopefully. I like to think I'm a pretty good cook.
Because I find that my wife is a very good cook. Hi, Bonnie. She was strong in chemistry also. And actually went to the same college that you did, Drew University. Way back, graduated in 1961. And in those days, women were not encouraged to go on for graduate studies. So she did not do that in chemistry. But she was strong in it and realizes now, later on, in life that she could have done that, but there was a certain reluctance to have women forge ahead with advanced degrees at that point. And so I sort of think when I hear somebody strong in chemistry, I wonder if the cooking is something that kind of grabs you too.
Definitely. It's certainly something you're always thinking about.
All right. And Sean, speaking of cooking, are you doing cooking nowadays?
Yes. So historically, I work in kitchens. And so now that I've graduated Muhlenberg and I haven't really applied to grad schools yet, I'm working on that currently. I'm working in a kitchen, Cali Burrito. And that's cooking is one of my favorite things.
So if you want to see Sean's face, you can go to Cali Burrito.
And,
one of these days.
And walk into the kitchen. That, you can't walk into the kitchen there now.
So,
touch all your burritos,
Sean, you mentioned grad school.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a major in mind, a focus that you're really interested in for graduate school?
So I have multiple focuses, which is the kind of dilemma here. I'm really interested in like geographic and geospatial imagery, GIS stuff, through Dr. Carter. I'm also very interested in osteoarchaeology, which is something I'm kind of starting from scratch from.
Osteoarchaeology. That is a new word for
mm-hmm.
me. Now, what does that mean?
That's bones. It's the pathology of humans. So like analyzing archaeological remains of humans for causes of death, types of life, situations. You can learn a lot from like bones and teeth.
Yes, bones and teeth. Huh?
Right.
And those are the things that remain after the rest of us has disappeared in the grave.
Correct.
Okay. So it seems to me that's a huge area then, osteoarchaeology.
Yeah.
And that's the first time that I've heard of that. Getting back to Dr. Carter's background, he has a Master of Arts degree, though he prefers to call it an AM. And do you remember the Latin term for that?
No.
All right. He told me off the air that it's really an MA, but at Washington University in St. Louis, they call it an AM. God bless them. In anthropological sciences.
Correct.
So, what's the difference between anthropology and anthropological sciences, Dr. Carter?
Well, that's a that we could talk for a very long time about that. In anthropology, there's been a long discussion about the role of the humanities versus the sciences within anthropology, and certainly my favorite thing about anthropology is it's a very humanistic science, and it's a very scientific. Humanities profession.
Right. So you're in between those two areas. That's
correct. So
interesting.
So anthropological sciences, I think, is what WashU came up with to sort of try to solve that. I don't think it really was any different than probably everybody else's degree in anthropology.
But they came up with that anthropological sciences instead of anthropological arts, which they could have named it also,
correct.
Right? Just doesn't sound, well, as scientific. That's all. So this evening, we're going to be talking about, suppose we call this version, this edition tonight of Lehigh Valley Discourse, Dig the Poconos. Does that describe it?
Sean kind of likes that. Well, I'm not 100% sure where the line for the Poconos is. We're looking at the Blue Mountain, which is the sort of first ridge. And I think the Poconos are beyond that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. So, maybe one of your listeners will correct us.
Yeah. Is Blue Mountain in the Poconos?
Okay. There's a question that I can't answer. Why are we talking even about – let's go back to something that you mentioned, Sean, which is GIS.
Mm-hmm.
What does that stand for? What is this whole area?
Geographic Information System or
–
yeah,
mm-hmm.
systems.
And so what does that involve?
That's the use of technology, really, mapping software, mapping in general, satellites or just –
okay, so mapping the earth,
mm-hmm.
mapping mountains and valleys and whatever there is on earth. And so, and you did a workshop about that.
Well, I think the key to GIS, it's definitely mapping,
mm-hmm.
but imagine being able to layer on top of each other, you know, 30 different maps, and you can sort of flip back and forth through them. So the key is being able to take disparate maps and being able to pull them into one system so you can see all these different types of data together. So I use historic maps. I use LIDAR data, which we can talk about more. We use modern maps. We can pull in Google Maps. We can use our own. We can record our own location with GPS and pull that data in. So we can pull in. So out in the field, we can actually see on a tablet as we're walking through a historic landscape.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That's revolutionary. Huh?
I think so.
I agree.
In the last decade or so, would you say this is developed?
Yes. I mean, there's some of the bigger companies, some of the commercial companies, you've been able to do this for a while. But, of course, that means you have to pay a lot of money also. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I try to stress is I use all open source tools, which means that every tool that I use in the field is available to all of your listeners as well. And to my students. So, for example, if a student were to use an expensive piece of software and then were to graduate and want to do some of this work, they're kind of up a creek.
Yeah.
Which is honestly what happened to me when I graduated from grad school. I wanted to do some of the GIS, but I didn't have a license to the expensive programs.
Oh.
So I've started using these open source programs, and they have become the sort of center of my research.
Okay. Have you, in a way, invented this?
No.
Are you the first one to say this is open and everyone can access?
No. This is a movement that's been out there for a very long time. Open source GIS projects have been going on for many decades. I can't even tell you. Even going back to the 70s. I mean, some of these programs stem from federal government departments and you know, big schools, and they would produce some software and put it out there. But even when I was in grad school, a lot of these open source tools were very techie friendly. In other words, they weren't user friendly to the rest of us.
Right.
Okay.
Over the past 10, maybe 20 years, that's changed completely. So the tools that I use QGIS, which is a GIS program. And it is extremely user friendly at this point. So okay. I'm now teaching all sorts of people how to use it.
Do you use that in courses at Muhlenberg College at all?
I do. I do. As a matter of fact, we're hoping to start up some GIS classes as well.
Wow. Very, very interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned LIDAR data. What's that?
So LIDAR is it's actually a very simple technology. It's lasers. You shoot a laser at a surface, and the laser bounces back. And based upon time of flight, the amount of time that it took to go from the source and return to the source, you can use the speed of light and therefore get a distance. So that's all it is, but it's a little bit more complex in the sense that the entire state of Pennsylvania, they flew a little plane over it and they shot the ground. They swept the ground, the LIDAR back and forth, and collected laser points all over the entire state, almost approximately one per every, let's say, 10 square feet.
Oh, my goodness. Do you know if that's been done in other states?
It has been done, but we're particularly lucky to be in Pennsylvania, one, because the entire state was done. In other states, for example, I know Maine particularly well, they did the coast because they're worried about the sea level rise, et cetera. So they're very concerned about the coast, so they did within a few miles of the coast. But they haven't done the inland. Pennsylvania has done every square
inch
meter
of the whole state. Mm-hmm.
And here's the key. Pennsylvania provides all of that data openly. So you and I and any Pennsylvania citizen, but anybody at all can find this data and view it online. Pennsylvania has the Pennsylvania Imagery Navigator, which is one of the places where you can find almost any type of map that the state has produced. And download it for yourself.
And not even just the maps. You can download the raw data points that generated by the LIDAR, which is really cool because you can manipulate that yourself and not have to depend on manipulation from another institution.
So one of the ways that I started identifying these charcoal hearths was through that online map, right? It was something I wanted to check out, and I found the online map, and I was like, oh, wait, I can see the charcoal hearths in the map. in the LIDAR data on the map. And so then I was able to, that prompted me to try to find more, and I kept finding more and more and more. And so that's, in many ways, that's what's led to the research we're going to discuss today.
Pretty exciting. Yeah. So my guests this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse are Dr. Ben Carter from Muhlenberg College and Sean Kenny, a recent graduate of Muhlenberg. And we're congratulating him on his completion of his bachelor's degree. Looking forward to a master's and perhaps a PhD at some point, Sean?
Yep, definitely looking forward to a master's and a PhD is the end game.
All right. So. And a shout out to your girlfriend because she's still at Muhlenberg College, right?
Yes, she is.
All right. What's her name?
Sam Brown, senior at Muhlenberg College.
All right. She better be listening this evening. And Ben, what about you, your family? What's the extent of your nuclear family?
So my wife is Kathleen, is a high school math teacher over across the river over in New Jersey at North Honorton High School, and my boys are both at Moravian Academy. One's a freshman this year, and one's a senior, starting to get those college
applications.
The acceptance letters are starting to roll in.
Oh, that's great, and. We're going to be talking this evening somewhat about charcoal, and you've already mentioned Blue Mountain. That is the place where you have done your digging?
Correct. And so just if you go basically from Allentown, if you go up the Lehigh River, you hit the Lehigh Gap, and probably lots of people know the Lehigh Gap Nature Center. So that's actually one of the reason why this all started was because I'm from Maine, and I came to the Lehigh Valley, and I was looking for places to hike, and that was one of the places to hike. So I'd spent a decent amount of time there, and I kept seeing these flat areas on the landscape, and I thought, wow, this is really cool. They've got a whole bunch of tenting spaces flattened on the side of the mountain. I've never seen that before. This is such a unique way of sort of accommodating people on a mountain.
Now, wait a second. What does the tenting amount to?
So we can talk a bit more about what a charcoal hearth is, but the remains of them on the landscape is about a 30-foot diameter flat area on the landscape. So imagine the slope of a mountain, and they dug into the mountain and pulled some of that dirt out and have a flat area. And so a lot of people camp on these, and so that's why I thought they were designed as tenting sites, but it turns out that they're actually for making charcoal.
Uh-huh. So they were digging charcoal out of the side of the mountain, and people decided, well, this is a nice flat place. Let's do some camping here.
Right. So it's not the charcoal that they're digging out. They're just digging out the dirt, and they're making a flat area. And
so
then
they make the charcoal on top.
And then they make the – oh, we're going to get into that when we come back from our break. Folks, this is Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we are talking about archaeology this evening. Hang in there. We must take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and it may be tax-deductible. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Dr. Ben Carter, professor at Muhlenberg College, and Sean Kenny, recent graduate from Muhlenberg College. In fact, Sean, you were a student of Dr. Carter's, correct?
Correct, yeah.
How many courses did you take with him? Do you remember?
Oh, wow. I guess starting from my sophomore year, at least once a semester, sometimes twice. So
at least six?
Yeah.
So, well, you got to know each other, the two of
you. That's right. That's right.
So, Sean, a philosophical question.
Okay.
Did you find that the semesters passed quickly as you went from one to the next?
Yes, actually.
Man, where did that semester go? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't that happen in a class period where the minutes drag on?
Not in my classes, right, Sean?
No.
There you go.
Very true.
I knew he had to say that. So we're talking about digging. We're talking about archaeology this evening. and particularly Blue Mountain. Ben, you mentioned that you are from Maine.
Correct.
Originally, and the first time that you left Maine was for college?
Yes, I wanted to leave Maine, so that's why I went to Drew University.
Why did you want to leave Maine?
Well, because I was a teenager, and I wanted to yeah. get away.
You wanted to get away.
There was,
to
New Jersey. Now, of course, all I want to do is go back. But,
yeah, but because you're from the coast, and big difference in Maine between the coast
absolutely.
And inland.
Absolutely.
And so, wow, you were in a great position to be right there on the ocean.
I grew up climbing mountains and canoeing and kayaking in and around Acadia National Park.
So. Do you still get a kick out of doing those things?
Of course.
And have taught your boys to do that
absolutely.
Too? Wonderful. And you can't wound up in Pennsylvania here where we can't offer an ocean to you.
No.
You could go to the Jersey Shore once in a while.
Very different.
But the, all right, no mountains there, right?
Just beach.
So, Dr. Ben Carter, hey, good sense of humor. I love to have him on the air. This is your second time with me
Correct.
Here, Ben. So, Sean, see that Sean is new to WDIY.
Yep.
We welcome you, and
Thank
you can
you.
See that Dr. Carter survived the first verbal abuse that he took here on Lehigh Valley Discourse. And here we are. It's all fun. So let's get to some of your motivation. What would you say interested you first, Sean, about archaeology? Can you put it into words?
So when I first came to Muhlenberg, I was actually I had not declared, but I had expressed interest in political science as a major. My advisor when I first came in freshman year was political science, and she advised me to take an anthropology class as a way to kind of complement political science.
Okay.
And I took that class. And
hey,
class.
That was great advice,
That's
wasn't
right,
it
was.
Were you sitting on her shoulder when she told
But that class stole me from political science. And so then through taking anthropology classes, I took the intro to archaeology and realized that it was working with my hands, which I love to do, and also a lot of just really cool knowledge-based stuff that I liked. Less, I guess, I don't want to say academic or philosophical than anthropology, but more like harder when it comes to like the science part. Being more hands-on, thank you. That's exactly right. What I was looking for. Right. It's more hands-on than anthropology and in the direction that I liked because it incorporated anthropology, which I was really interested in. That's what I did.
Right.
But in a different way that I liked more better.
It's interesting when you say use of your hands, because that comes in different professions, dentistry, medicine, and now archaeology, we find out. And Ben, I've always thought that when we see something about a find that somebody makes, and typically it might be the Middle East, let's say, and they're sitting there with these tiny brushes, and they're just brushing away, and they've suddenly come across a fragment of a bowl, and they get all excited about that, particularly if it still has color on it, right? It just looks to me like such tedious work.
Absolutely. It's incredibly tedious. I think one of the things that you have to recognize in archaeology is that every little tiny fragment of pottery, every little tiny fragment of glass, or every tiny rusted nail means something. Not only that, we pull together all these little tiny, you know, one little nail. It seems like that doesn't mean much, but we can do all sorts of really interesting stuff with all those little bits. Compare, let's say, there's lots of glass in this particular location on the site versus there's lots of nails in this particular location. That gives us an idea of what happened at the site. And so when you're digging, even though it's particularly tedious, it's very slow, it takes a great deal of time. And as Sean well knows, there's a lot of roots to cut and rocks to move out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're down on your hands and knees and your knees cramp up. They've got the rocks digging into your knee. So it's not just tedious. It's actually pretty uncomfortable.
Sean, do you use knee pads?
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah. Right. Similar to like what electricians and plumbers
use. Okay. Do you always use gloves when you're digging?
Yes. For protection as well, like protection from the elements that you're dealing with and also protecting those elements from you, because artifacts and stuff you really don't want to handle with bare hands, or certain ones you don't want to.
Right. You can do residue analyses, and if you contaminate them with your fingers, then you've contaminated the residues as well. So you do have to be careful about handling the artifacts with bare hands, right. Especially you know, if you were, we don't get human bone very often, but if you were, you don't want to handle human bone with your own hands because then you've contaminated the DNA.
Interesting. Yes, with our oils,
correct,
in, mm-hmm. in our skin. So, Ben, what drew you to the Blue Mountain particularly?
So I was, you know, I was being from Maine. I wanted to do some hiking, and so I went to the Lehigh Nature Gap, did some hiking, and started seeing these flat areas, as I mentioned earlier. And then I went, as wanting to know more, I went to the Pennsylvania Imagery Navigator, and I started, and you pulled up that LIDAR map, and started to see them all over the place. It literally, when you pull it up, it looks like the mountain has pimples.
Wow.
And so what we did then is then we pulled it into a GIS program where not only can you see things, but you can add data. So then we can put a little point, a little location on each one of them. And then we can start sort of getting an idea of where they all are rather than just sort of seeing, hey, there's a bunch. We can mark every single one.
And tell us again what GIS is.
GIS is Geographical Information Systems.
Okay. So, all right, here you have all these pimples on the mountain. You like that expression, huh, Sean? On the mountains or the hills or whatever we call this. We call it Blue Mountain. The folks from the Rockies would say, hey, that's not a mountain. Right.
It's a really long ridge. It's something like 250 mm-hmm. miles long. I mean, it's sizable in length, if not in height. One of the cool things, actually one of the great things about the Blue Mountain in terms of working with students is you can drive to the top, right? So we drive to the top, and we often have a hike into where we're working. But that's otherwise I'd have to hike to the top of the mountain and then hike in, and so it's much more convenient to work on the Blue Mountain.
Okay. And explain to us a little bit, when you take students there, is it a summer course? Is it part of your fall or spring courses? How long do you stay up on the mountain?
So for this particular work, what we've done is used a field archaeology class that I run every other fall. And we do some readings, you know, background readings about charcoal and about iron production, but also readings about archaeological methods. And then we go out in the field. And so we spend 8 Sundays on the mountain, usually about 8 hours per Sunday. And
so that does that mean about every other Sunday during the semester?
It depends upon the schedule.
Okay.
Sometimes there's
maybe it depends
on
the weather.
It does. And unfortunately, fall 2018, this last fall, we had some unfriendly weather conditions, so we got a lot less work done than we had hoped, but mm-hmm. but that's the way it works.
And when you're up there on a Sunday, how many hours does that take that you're out on the mountain?
Approximately 6 to 8, depending on how things are going.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what are you doing specifically, Sean? What are you looking for when you're up there?
So when we're up there, we're locating and confirming site identifications that we've made using the GIS and LIDAR imagery. And then when we locate and decide on a site that we find like favorable to how we're going to excavate, we begin the excavation procedures, which we're looking for evidence of occupation, types of occupation, and charcoal.
Right. And you're not looking for anything specific. It's just sort of like collecting data. Whatever happens, that's going to lead you a certain way.
Well, the excavation that we did this time around was specifically mm-hmm. focused on colliers' huts. So colliers are the men, and generally speaking, they were men. We found a little bit of evidence that there might have been some women involved, but generally speaking, this is men. Men who lived on the mountain usually for 8 months out of the year and made charcoal. So for that excavation, we're really interested in what was life like while they were living up on the mountain. So how does their artifact assemblage, all the stuff that we find?
Okay. What's the time frame of these folks living up there?
So the Blue Mountain was used for charcoal production around 1828 through 1878, maybe a little bit later.
Okay. 19th century.
19th century.
Most of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Actually. That's fascinating to think about people living up there. And that was their permanent housing.
No. So they lived up there for 8 months, mm-hmm. and they lived in a sort of conical shelter, and it was actually very similar to the charcoal hearths. So it was a wooden conical shelter made out of logs, covered with leaves and covered with dirt. And that's what they would live in for 8 months out of the year. And they were, let's say, they were probably maybe on the interior, maybe 12, 15 feet across. So pretty small space for
one or two people, maybe.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Usually it was often a collier and an assistant, which often was a son or mm-hmm. maybe a nephew or something like that.
What is a collier?
The collier is the charcoal burner, the guy who makes the charcoal. So I don't know if, Sean, you want to explain how the charcoal is made?
Okay. So charcoal, like on the charcoal hearth, after the surface has been graded and flattened so that you have like the 10 by 10-ish, 15-ish.
Feet.
Feet, yes. Charcoal pit, hearth. They'll collect wood. Either they'll chop down the wood themselves, like on site, or they'll have done it over the winter months. However, they'll have like wood prepped to create a mound of wood using lapwood and billets. Billets are smaller wood that make up most of the interior. Lapwood makes up most of the exterior of it.
All right, say these words again.
Sorry, lapwood
okay.
is a larger piece, plank of wood, basically. Think like a plank of wood, almost like a 2x4, but like flatter mm-hmm. and longer.
Okay.
And billets are smaller pieces of wood, roughly 5 inches by 2 inches, think, or 2 feet by 3 inches.
Okay.
Smaller than the lapwood and more thicker. And we'll make the billets will make the interior, and they'll stack the wood around in a circle, kind of in a beehive structure, and put the lapwood around that. Ooh, I just hit the mic, I'm sorry. They'll put the lapwood around that and cover the whole thing in dirt. With a hole in the center, which they will put a piece of green wood, so very freshly chopped wood that's still like slightly fire resistant due to the water that's still in there. And the rate at which that sinks in can determine how far along the stage the charcoal is being produced. And the reasoning this works is because they set it on fire on the inside. They drop hot coals, burning coals into there. But due to the covering with dirt and dust and leaves, it kind of like smolders the fire and keeps it at a nice charring process, which removes the water, oxygen, other things out of the wood and leaves you with mostly raw carbon with
few
impurities.
So charcoal is made out of wood.
Yes.
Correct.
I didn't know that.
Correct.
All right.
So in this case, yeah, the charcoal is made out of the wood that they cut from the mountain.
Okay. Now, it just occurred to me, difference between charcoal and coal.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Coal is?
Coal is usually mineral coal, mm-hmm. right?
Correct.
So that's dug out of the ground, out of a mine, which, of course, Pennsylvania is extremely well known for. In this area is particularly well known for hard coal, the anthracite. But so our charcoal production preceded that. And even once they started using anthracite coal for iron production, they continued to use charcoal for iron production as well. Charcoal is cleaner,
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
and so you get a cleaner burn. But it's also one of the problems with it is it's a little bit softer, and so it crushes more easily, and so you can only do it in fairly small furnaces, whereas anthracite can be used in larger furnaces because it doesn't. But anthracite is particularly mm-hmm. difficult to ignite. So once they figured out how to do that, then anthracite started to increase, and charcoal maintained for a good long time until we got to a point where we're making a lot of steel, et cetera, and then charcoal sort of falls off.
Because it's softer and it's smaller,
mm-hmm.
and not as – so coal is more industrial use.
Absolutely.
And charcoal, I think of today as grills, charcoal mm-hmm. grills.
I want to jump on a – thing that Dr. Carter said right here, where he mentioned that charcoal is cleaner than anthracite coal. It's not really, I guess, emissions based. Because when I hear something, oh, it's cleaner coal, I think of like emissions based standards. And charcoal is cleaner in the sense of impurities that it leaves in the final product. Burning coal creates a lesser grade iron. So as charcoal creates it. Since it has fewer impurities in it, the smoke and soot left over from that doesn't contaminate the iron as much, so it creates a higher quality of iron as opposed to anthracite coal.
Anthracite coal is, or anthracite iron, iron made with anthracite coal is a little bit more brittle and more difficult to work. And so people still wanted the iron made from made with charcoal. So that's why it even after anthracite was used, it began being used, it continued quite a lot because it was much nicer, much more pure iron.
And before we had all the steel production that came to be in the 19th century here in Pennsylvania, what was the use of the charcoal? Was it merely for heat for houses, or
no? The primary use. So the what we're studying right now is the Blue Mountain was used by the Balliet family, who owned two furnaces: one at Lehigh Furnace and one East Penn Furnace, one at south of the mountain and one north of the mountain. And so all of this charcoal was being made to go into those iron furnaces.
So, right. Yeah, the charcoal production mainly supported the iron industry in Pennsylvania and in usually in America where it was.
And then as we got more and more iron production and companies grew, then they could no longer use the charcoal.
Well, so it actually has a lot more to do with industrialization, and it has to do with anthracite can be brought into the city, right? I mean, that's it's one of the main things that you do with anthracite is move it around the landscape. So it was very easy then for Allentown, for example, to have all these furnaces downtown. So the industrial part of that is that then once you have the iron, then you can move it a very short distance and make railroad rails out of it, right? If you make on the charcoal model, these are large plantations out in the country. You make the iron and then you ship the iron off to go be made into something else somewhere else. And so with the concentration of industry in a place like Allentown, it was the benefits of anthracite coal became more and more apparent because you could do everything in a fairly concentrated area.
Mm-hmm. The more you transport charcoal, the more risk you have of it. It's very fragile and frangible. So the more transportation undergone by the charcoal themselves, like the pieces of charcoal, the more they fall apart and become turn into charcoal dust, which is relatively unusable. And also the higher risk, it's also very volatile. The higher risk for it igniting. So you put it on a train bumps, there's heat, friction, that train car has a strong chance of catching
fire. Not to speak of riding along with the charcoal as it's crumbling and you're wearing your white tuxedo. Not a good combo. Well, folks, we're having fun with this interview this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host. Neil Heaver is our engineer. Time to take another break. Stay with us, and we are going to continue our fascinating discussion about the production of coal, charcoal.
WDIY is celebrating our birthday, and you're invited to the party. Join us for a night of live music, food, drinks, and fun to mark WDIY's 24 years in the Lehigh Valley, featuring a performance from the Large Flowerheads, paying tribute to the best music of the 1960s. Saturday, March 2nd at the Ice House in Bethlehem. Get your tickets today at wdiy.org. We'll see you there.
We're back with Dr. Ben Carter, who is fascinated by a little image of spondylus. Now, Sean, that's probably a new word for you, is it?
No, it's not. A couple of years with Dr. Carter, you tend to learn what that is.
Is there any truth to the rumor that Dr. Carter teaching a course on anthropology or on it would be anthropology?
Sure.
With the spondylus. Now, spondylus, is it animal, vegetable, or mineral?
It's an animal.
It's an animal. It's a mollusk. Mm-hmm. So it's a small sea creature. And this is one of your specialties.
Correct. The local work that I've been doing on charcoal and a few other things is somewhat the main reason for doing it. Number one, I've always been fascinated by people's use of landscape. But the other reason is that I want to get my students out in the field and doing archaeology because I think that's incredibly important for understanding how it's done and how you get data and how that data is then understood. And so my original research is in South America, largely on this bivalve known as spondylus.
Okay, let's spell it for the folks. S-P-O-N.
S-P-O-N-D-Y-L-U-S.
Right. Spondylus. That was it. When I first met Dr. Carter, that was a first, that was a new word for me. Is there any truth to the rumor that when you teach a 14-week semester, you spend 10 weeks on spondylus and 4 on other lesser interesting things?
I certainly try not to spend too much time on it. It is incredibly important in South American prehistory.
And you have a passion for it, too. So,
mm-hmm. And well, everybody does. It's fun. They just don't know it yet.
Spondylus. So you mentioned doing research in South America.
Correct.
Which country or countries?
Ecuador. Mostly Ecuador, a little bit of Peru as well.
All right. Mm-hmm. And Sean, you had the opportunity to go to Peru.
Yes, I did. This just past summer, 2018, I was there for a month. It was for field school. It was not associated with Dr. Carter's work, but it was very, like, the reason I chose it was very influenced by Dr. Carter's work.
All right. And you went with a program with other students?
Correct.
And what did you do exactly in Peru?
So we were in the Ayacucho region at an archaeological site studying biological evidence of a civilization that was pre-Inca, actually. So it was a little bit older than when people think of Peru, usually they think of like the Incas and
Correct.
All that. This is a empire that existed before that, and this was a site that was occupied by them. And we were just analyzing the finds from certain areas within this city that we...
And Dr. Carter, from when we think of the Incas, what time span were they prominent?
Oh, very late. So it depends upon where you put your beginner market, but let's say 1400 through. Mm-hmm. And often people draw the line at the arrival of Pizarro, 1532. Okay. But the Inca certainly continued on, and certainly descendants of the Inca continue on today.
Right.
Yeah. But generally, when we're talking about the archaeological group and historic, ethno-historic group known as the Inca, we're talking about roughly 1400 through the arrival of Pizarro.
So late Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
that would be
sure.
Me.
Yeah.
I guess I don't know. I don't know my
Middle
European.
Ages up to about 1500 or so.
Okay.
You're right. That we do consider that more with Europe than with the Americas. So that's a fascinating experience that you had to get to go to Peru. Did you get to go to Machu Picchu?
No, we were far north from that and in the desert highlands. So I did not do any real traveling outside of what I was there to do with the archaeology.
You have to have several days to
exactly.
really do that.
Yeah.
So maybe sometime in the future,
maybe
you
in the
go
future.
Back. Yes. But pre-Inca society.
Mm-hmm. So this society was around from roughly 200 to 800 AD. So this society predated the Incas, and actually a lot of things we associate with the Inca was kind of pioneered and used by this society. It's the Wari Society. Many of the Inca roads were built by them, and they also helped. They didn't exactly invent the megalithic structures and the very, like the Inca roads, the Inca blocks, like the very, like, wow, these rocks have been carved so perfectly, right angles,
yes.
straight.
Yes.
That technology knowledge predated the Wari, but the Wari really expanded upon it and used it in a lot of their stuff, from Inca took. And
it built walls and buildings without any mortar.
Correct.
Right? And so that comes from even before the Incas.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And yet the Incas get all the press. And what was the name of the group pre-Inca?
The Huari.
Huari.
Yes.
Spelled two different ways, W-A-R-I or H-U-A-R-I.
Okay.
So the way that we learned it down in Peru was the society was called the H-U-A-R-I. That's them as a whole, but their capital city is W-A-R-I.
Interesting. All right, spelled both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, let's get back to this fascinating topic of mapping. When you said that, imagine that you have 30 maps on top of each other. I don't see how you keep from getting confused which era is which, But let's give our listeners a way that they could go in and see for themselves. Where would they go on the computer?
So the one of the, you can't really do GIS on the web. So in order for your listeners to sort of do what we can do, they would have to sort of get some training in GIS and download QGIS and use that. However, to get sort of started, one of the best tools out there is this Pennsylvania Imagery Navigator. And so they can Google that, and what that will show them is you can't see multiple layers at the same time, but you can zoom in on one section of Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. and there are historic maps, there are recent maps, there are satellite maps, et cetera. So they can and there's the LIDAR maps as well. There's a hillshade map derived from the LIDAR that they can see the context of the land or the contours of the land, and so they can flip back and forth between these and see the same spot with different maps. Hmm. Now in GIS we can do this and we can change the transparency of one, and so we can actually see one map through the other one. So if I want to see how a historic map lines up with the modern map, I can make the historic map transparent and see where things align.
All right. And when you're doing, let's give the name again. Pennsylvania
Imagery Navigator.
Okay.
And so, and again, I'll sort of offer up thanks and to the state of Pennsylvania for putting all of this stuff online. I've worked in other states, and it's just not as easy in other states.
Right. Does the impetus for this come from a university in Pennsylvania?
It's all – I believe all of the geographic data is centered at Penn State. So I think – I don't know the history of it, but I do think that Penn State had something to do with the organization of this. So I think all the data exists, right, and Penn State was involved in pulling it all together. I mean, it's incredibly useful for – anybody. I mean, developers, if they wanted to know what the landscape looks like through time and see where buildings are, et cetera.
Mineral exploration.
Yep.
That's a natural.
Yep.
And the when you're using the GIS and you have these various maps, are you always comparing only two maps?
No.
No. You can have as many as 30 there at the same time?
Yes. And so you can – so there's two different types of GIS data. One are rasters, and rasters are like pictures. So imagine a historic map overlaid over a modern map, right? Those are two raster maps. Okay. What I can do also, though, is let's say the old map has roads. I can trace the roads in what we call vector data, so that would just basically be lines, and then I can turn off the raster layer, the historic map, and I can still see those lines on top of the modern landscape. Okay. But now I can also take a different map, and let's say I have a map of iron mines, and I can draw those iron mines onto a vector layer as well, and then I can pull away the raster layer, pull away the historic map, and I can see, so now I can see the modern map with historic roads on it with historic iron mines. Wow. And so then I can keep pulling in all of this diverse data, and I can then see it in the same space. So I've done it with iron mines, and you can see where all the iron mines were in Lehigh mm-hmm. County. It's pretty neat because some of them are still there, some of them are totally gone, some of them are ponds at golf courses and stuff like that.
Some are still active?
They're not active. They're just they're the holes are still
there.
The holes are there. They're just iron in this area was mined mostly in pits, not in mines. It was in quarries, small, generally speaking, and it was generally a something that farmers did in the off season. Right. So on their land, they just basically dig a hole and pull out some iron and ship it off to the furnaces and sell it.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've talked about the historically how charcoal was made, and particularly on Blue Mountain. That's where you've concentrated your digging, correct?
Correct. Correct. Although we haven't – I've actually not done much digging because digging is destruction, right? And you have to record every last little detail. And so you have to have a really good research question and idea about exactly what you want to find before you go and dig. So we did a little bit of digging this fall, but it was honestly pretty minor, and we didn't get very far.
All right. Yeah. Well, who decides whether your proposal is worthwhile or not to do a dig?
In this particular case, there's not really because it's through Muhlenberg. And they fund the bus or the van up and back, and they buy some of the tools that we use. So it's essentially funded by Muhlenberg. There's no granting agency. Right. However, we do have to justify it to the state. This is on state game lands, and so the state has to be involved. And so we have to justify it to the State Game Commission, of course. It's on their land. But any archaeological work that's done on state land also has to go through the Pennsylvania Historic and Museum Commission as well. So we have permission from those two groups, and we do have to have sort of a research program to explain to them why we want to do this, and they okay it.
Do you have an interview where you have to go and explain this, or is it all by sending?
No, it's all written.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Sean, that's quite an education for you to learn about all these things, even the bureaucracy that you have to go through.
Which is really important for any future archaeological research. A lot of archaeological jobs and even just programs that you can apply to, they ask for experience in XYZ form drafting or grant writing, stuff like that.
Right.
No, I wanted to throw out there that I seem to remember that we haven't mentioned what we've found so far. So using these techniques, we've found from the Lehigh Gap to 309 along the Blue Mountain, which is about 12 miles long and about 20 square miles, the area that we're working in, we've found 740 charcoal hearths.
Whoa.
Yep.
Right. So we're working where we can see we have an old map of the Balliet lands, these owners of the furnace, that shows 6,000 acres. So we know they own that. We're positive they own more, but we don't know exactly how much. So they own 6,000 plus acres. And then even beyond that 6,000 acres, there's charcoal hearths everywhere. So this mountain, if you walked along this mountain, as the Appalachian Trail goes through there today, if you followed where the Appalachian Trail is, you would have walked through a very smoky environment. Mm-hmm. Imagine trees cut down, lots of trees cut down.
Now you're talking 19th century?
Correct, yes, in the 19th century. Right, this would have been in one of the most exciting things about this is, today there's the Appalachian Trail and people walk through there and they're sort of, this is nature.
Right.
Just 100 years ago,
there's nothing.
This was an industrial landscape, and so what you see today is the remains of that landscape. So what existed prior to the charcoal production is very different from what you see today.
Okay. Very different trees, very different plant life.
All right. Yeah. Fewer trees, smaller plants, or can you guess what there was?
Not really fewer trees, because of course they've had 100 years to recover at this point. Mm-hmm. So there's obviously lots of trees. Generally speaking, there's not very many big ones, right? If you go up on the mountain and try to find a tree that's, two feet in diameter, good luck.
Yeah.
Right? So we don't know exactly what's changed. But we do know that all of this charcoal production would have had a significant impact. One of the big things, of course, is that much of the charcoal was made from chestnut, and of course, chestnut has been destroyed. Right, it suffers from a blight in the early 20th century, and is now gone. So that's another. I mean, that's outside of the charcoal
decimation from the industry and the blight that affected it has had really small ability, low ability to kind of re-pioneer and regenerate in this area.
And chestnut wood was very prominent in charcoal making.
Oh, yes. Chestnut has two impressive properties that make it almost ideal for charcoal production. One, it's hard. So the charcoal that you make out of it doesn't crumble. If you make it out of a pine or something, the charcoal just sort of falls
apart. You're just
going to
get dust.
And it burns a lot longer. So you make one out of pine, it's successful, doesn't crumble to dust. You burn it, it burns for a very short period of time because there's less actual wood, less actual carbon in there. Hardwood's so dense, it burns longer and slower.
Correct. And chestnut has the property of regrowing from its stump. So in order to regenerate, right, in order to make more charcoal in the same place, if you plant by trees, generally speaking, and we're talking about averages here, you would have to wait like 30 years. But with chestnut, because it will regrow from the stump, from the roots, mm-hmm. it takes maybe 20.
Yeah.
So it was the using charcoal was actually fairly sustainable, right? You would make some charcoal, come back in 20 years, the trees would have regrown, make some more, and you know you could do this multiple times through
that. Pass it on generation to generation.
Correct, exactly. You just
family.
Rotate what area per year you make charcoal. 20 years, the first area you made will be good. Year after that,
right. So each year depends upon how you calculate. But each year you use around 300 acres of forest land to run a furnace.
Yeah.
So you need. So if you think about that, times 20, right? Because it takes 20 years to regenerate. You need at least 6,000 acres of land to keep the furnace running.
And that's what you found that the original owners.
Correct. Well, they had 6,000, and we know more, but we don't know how much more. I can't give you a number on how much more.
And that stretches both south and north of Blue Mountain?
Mostly along the mountain.
Along
the
mountain.
So the south side and the north side of the mountain.
But along the mountain.
Do you know anything about the family? It's Balliet?
The Balliets. Mm-hmm. We do know a lot about the family.
Okay.
They're heavily involved in iron production, both charcoal-based and coal-based.
Well, folks, this is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm John Pierce, your host, and Ben and Sean, our time is up, believe it or not.
Right.
When you're having fun, it passes quickly.
Very quickly. Right?
Just like the semesters, Sean.
Well, thank you very much, John, for inviting us in.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Love having you back here. This is Dr. Carter's second visit with us on Lehigh Valley Discourse. This is Sean's debut. And we can look forward to another time, perhaps in the future. And Sean, best of luck with your plans for graduate school.
Thank you very much.
Dear listeners, thank you for tuning in this evening to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY. We are Lehigh Valley Public Radio, 88.1 FM and WDIY.org. Neil Heaver has done our good work for us on the board this evening. Thank you, Neil. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.